Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer.
Our guest this week grew up in Bangor, Michigan, and earned a degree from Olivet College. From 1968 to 1970, he served in the U.S. Army as a medic in Vietnam. On May 13, 1969, for 49 hours, he was part of an attack on Nguyen Hill. He saved the lives of 10 wounded members of his company. He came back home and taught and coached at South Haven High School for 47 years. On July 31st, 2017, President Trump presented him our country's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. Known as Doc, his name, Jim McLuhan. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to an American hero, Jim Doc McLuhan. Doc, welcome. An honor to have you.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, my dad, I actually was born in South Haven, Michigan, but my dad moved the family to a shell of a house that his grandfather and grandmother had given him in Bangor, about 7 miles away from South Haven. And my mom and dad were both blue-collar workers as us kids grew up. We didn't have any electricity till I was about 5, and we didn't have running water till I was 8. So it was, I thought everybody else lived like that. So when you're in Rome, you know as the Romans do. And, I always said we weren't poor. We just didn't have very much money.
Jim, what's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Well, my mom's parents died before she was 3, and I learned that even though she didn't have parents, she was raised by grandparents, that anybody can do anything if they put their mind to it. She didn't have a lot of, examples, but she raised 3 boys who went on to, all 3 have master's degrees and be the first to graduate from college, and of course, a college with a master's degree too. But for my dad, was just a really hard worker. He built the house from the ground up, and then he put the basement in after he did the house with a shovel and a wheelbarrow. I don't think anybody would do that today, but my dad did. My dad was one of those people that gave you everything that he had. He'd give you the shirt off of his back, even if he wouldn't have a shirt for himself. So I learned, compassion, and I learned hard work. And I also learned that nobody's any better than anybody else, that everybody is equal. It doesn't matter what your job is in a group or on a team or in our family. Everybody had to do their job and make sure that, and of course, that followed me into my military career, and it certainly followed me into my coaching and teaching career, where everyone in the classroom was equal and everyone on the team was equal.
Speaking of team, you were a four-sport varsity athlete at Bangor High School, and you wrestled, played football and baseball at Olivet College, all of 5'5", 130. How good were you?
How good was I? I don't know. I was the best I could be. Just to add to what you just said, though, I didn't wrestle in high school. I was a basketball player in high school, and I had never seen a high school or a college wrestling match. I'd never seen anybody wrestle, and they've never let me forget when they recruited me, that the first year that I was at Olivet, they were just starting a team. And I found out later that I was the guy that broke the camel's back. The president was so annoyed by these guys coming back and asking him if we could have a team, that he said, if you can get one more guy out, I'll back the team. And I was that guy that they kept coming back to. But I walked into that room the first day, And I looked around and I said, hey, where's the ropes? I've seen this on TV and there should be ropes. So the only thing I had ever seen was pro wrestling with my grandpa yelling at the TV set, you know. And anyway, I went on to become a two-time conference champion in a sport that I had not participated in. But you said I was a 5'2", 5'5", 130 pounds. That was during football season. I played football at 160 or 165. So I lost the weight to wrestle at 130 pounds in the wintertime.
When we were kids, we were watching The Bruiser and The Crusher. So
you betcha, man. You that pro wrestling. And if you can imagine, every time they came back to me, I'm thinking, I don't want to go jumping off any ropes, you know, or slamming somebody on the floor. So anyway, I learned quickly that what it was all about.
All right. You graduated in May of 68, and you accepted a teaching and football coaching position at South Haven High School. But 3 months later, August 29th, 1968, you were drafted into the U.S. Army. How did you ever become a medic?
Well, I have my theory, and I'm sure it's very accurate, because being a draftee, they do not get those kinds of jobs. I called being a medic a positive job in a negative situation, because I could make people well. I could give them pain relievers. I could save their life. Well, other people, you know, are taking lives. And by the way, though, I did shoot a weapon, because Vietnam was the first time that medics also carried weapons and fought right out front with the rest of the grunts. But and preparing to be a coach, I took kinesiology, physiology, anatomy, first aid, advanced first aid, strapping and taping. So I think they saw that I had a little bit of background and maybe you know, first aid and being there for emergency situations. So I think it really did prepare me well, because I would have people, when they were spraining their ankles or hurt a joint or anything, come to me to wrap it up, even if they weren't from my platoon. I was a platoon medic.
We're talking to Jim McLuhan. And in March of 1969, he goes to Vietnam. When we come back, we're going to talk about that chapter of his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Jim McLuhan, known as Doc. Doc, let's go back to March 7th, 1969. You're in Vietnam. Talk about the first day you're in Nam.
Well, the very first 2 days that I was in Nam, I was supposed to be there for a week, but I took an orientation where they would tell us all the different kinds of poisonous snakes and animals in certain areas. At that particular time, the first time that you go in, you do not know where you're going to end up, unlike a lot of the other wars. We didn't go over as a unit. We went over as individuals, and then they plugged us in where they needed us. But after 2 days, Charlie Company, 3rd Battalion, 21st Infantry Regiment of the 196th Brigade, Americal Division, needed a platoon medic in the 2nd Platoon. So the second day, they cut my orientation short and put me on a helicopter, gave me a backpack and a weapon and a helmet, and off I went. I got off of the helicopter, and there were two gentlemen in front of me who later would really save my life, because they were such good machine gunners and covered me quite often when I was in dangerous situations. One was Sergeant Mittendorf, and the other one was Sergeant Hatton. Sergeant Hatton had his hat on crooked. He had a tooth missing in front, and he talked real slow. And Sergeant Mittendorf, he swore about every third word. But what I found out about these two gentlemen was that they might only have a high school education, and I had a college degree. They had a master's degree in fighting war, and I was a kindergartner. And those things that we talked about earlier about people being equal, well, some people have certain talents and skills that they can offer to the team, and other people have other skills that they can offer to the team. I was a medic. They were the machine gunners, but the medic really couldn't do his job without these guys covering me. And let me tell you, they taught me a lot about survival, about not jumping headfirst into something, be very careful about going to a certain location. Or they would tell me, oh, you know, you might carry a few more grenades in this mission, because they had that sixth sense that we were going to be in some deep doo-doo, so to speak. So they would always prepare me and say, do this, do that. Make sure you're careful here. Make sure you do not go over there. Those kinds of things that really helped out.
All right, let's go back to May 13th, 1969, 48 hours of hell. What happened, Jim?
I'm going to go back to the first day, too, because that first day I was in my first ambush. I had my very first wounded in action. I had two men wounded in action, and I had two killed in action. And I also killed my very first enemy, which was just shocking to me that I had pulled the trigger and taken someone's life. But May 13th, actually the day before, was another part of that big mission. Our captain, who was only a lieutenant at the time, but he later became a captain, he was our company commander, and he was called into the battalion headquarters. And a battalion commander, a lieutenant colonel, told him that he was going to take us into Nguyen Hill in the Tam Kỳ area, and that we were going to be a blocking force for a unit that was going to they were going to flush some NVA off of a hill, Nguyen Hill. Well, the company commander said, you know, this is really a flawed mission, because we don't know how many enemy soldiers are on that hill, and we don't even know what kind of firepower they have. Usually they send in at what's called a LERP unit, or an observation unit, and they check out how many, you know, enemy soldiers are in the area. Well, the lieutenant was told by the battalion commander, you're either going to take your men in there or we're going to court-martial you. Well, he knew that if they court-martialed him, they would send somebody else as our leader into that battle. And I'm a very lucky man. This was his second tour. Him being there and being able to call in the proper, you know, support, call in the Air Force, call in the Marines, call in the Navy, and so on and so forth, really saved the lives of the 32 men who ended up walking out of there. Of course, we haven't mentioned that there was only 89 of us that went in on that combat assault mission that morning of the 13th of May, 1969. We later found out there were anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 NVA and 700 VC on that hill. And so we were outnumbered, and it was a flawed mission. But there we were, stuck with either fighting as hard as we could to survive or getting overran.
All right. On the second day, you lose your only other medic, Private First Class Dan Shea. You were wounded twice yourself, and they offered to have you leave. Why didn't you, Jim?
Yeah, the first day I was wounded once and quite badly with rocket-propelled grenade shrapnel. And I didn't leave because I had glanced up on the hill when my platoon went out the first evening, and I could see it was about a mile away. The Nguyen Hill was about a mile away, and they looked like lava coming down off that hill. So I knew that they were going to need me. That particular time, I knew that Dan Shea was still with us, and of course, I was with him. But two medics to cover a whole unit is not a lot of medics. But my father had told me at a very young age that, Jim, when you're given a job to do, you never do it halfway. You do it to the best of your ability, but you don't quit until a job is finished. And, you know, I would rather be dead in a rice paddy than alive in a hospital and find out that one of my men the next day was killed because their medic was not there to help them or to actually save their life.
You guys were outnumbered 30-1, and yep. you saved 10 of your team, along with one Vietnamese interpreter. In those 48 hours of hell, Jim, was God with you during those 48 hours?
Oh, yeah, I think that he is. I don't picture God as having us like puppets on a string where he can save one person and let another person die. I think that that happens because of, like I said before, you have to be cautious and you have to think ahead. I think he can inspire you to do the right things and be cautious and be calm. I think that under situations where you need to be calm, then you can get things done better. But the second, one of the biggest lessons that I ever have learned in my life happened the second day of that battle. I had just bandaged up a man who had been shot in the stomach. His organs were out, some of them, and I put them back in and put pressure bandages on him. And then I took my own water, which I had nothing to eat or drink for the 48 hours that we were in this battle. But I took and put water on there so that his organs would not dry up. And I drug him into a trench line that the French had left there in the French-Vietnamese War. And I'm trying to contemplate as to how I'm going to carry this man to safety because I can't throw him over my shoulder. And I finally decided that I would cradle him in my arms like a baby and carry him through the crossfire and hope that we didn't get hit. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a thought came over me that had been since I was a small boy that I had told my father that I loved him. I knew he loved me, and I assumed that he knew I loved him. We were very close. He was a best friend as well as a father. But I had a little conversation with God that in that trench line, and I said, "Lord, if you let me get out of this hell on earth so I can tell my father one more time that I love him, I'll try to be the best dad and the best teacher and the best coach that I can be." And an incredible peace came over me, Jack. It was like it wasn't in my ballpark anymore. It was like if something happens to me in this battle, that's the plan, you know? And I ran to my dad in the airport in Chicago, Illinois, threw my arms around him when I got home and told him I loved him. And he did the same thing. Like, we'd been doing that for the 24 years of my life so far at that time. It was our greeting and our departure from then on. And I taught my children, my grandchildren, my athletes, and the coaches that I worked with that it's okay for a man to tell somebody that they love him. There's all kinds of love out there. And of course, a father-son love is very important. And I was afraid that I was going to die a long ways away from home and not confirm with my father that I really loved him.
We're talking to Jim McLuhan, who came home in March of 1970. We'll talk about the next chapter in his glorious life when we come back. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Jim McLuhan, who's one of 67 living Medal of Honor recipients. Jim, from 1970 to 2008, 38 years, you taught sociology and psychology, and you coached football, baseball, and wrestling at South Haven High School. Talk to us about the millennials and the Gen Zers today. What do they want? What do they need, Jim?
Well, they need the same thing all of us need. They need love. They need to feel self-worth. And I'm just hoping that things head back in that direction. Of course, with the unemployment the way it is right now, the biggest thing isn't about the money. The biggest thing is about the self-worth that individuals who don't have a job or are not even seeking a job, that self-worth is something that they don't have and they won't know unless they get out there and give their particular selves to something greater than themselves. We're not put on this good old earth for us. We're put on this good old earth to serve other people. So whatever it is that God has given us as far as talent and skills. That's what we need to do. Coaching was a perfect, perfect job for me because I fell in love with athletics at a very young age, and now I could transfer my playing days. Although I played a little softball, you know, I continued to play a little softball while I was coaching, but could turn that playing Jim McLuhan into a coaching Jim McLuhan. And I really, really loved being around athletes. I think one thing that we need to know is often the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and all of these bad kids get the attention. You know, we talked about shooters and this and that and the other thing. And you know that of the 26 shooters, this is an interesting statistic. The 26 shooters in school situations, all but one of them were fatherless. So it's up to us to guide, like our parents did us, to guide the next generation into being the type of person who is a team player, the type of person who is willing to give, as I said before, something greater or give to something greater than themselves. It kept my mind off of things that I had seen as a combat medic. And I can tell you right now that the combat medic sees things that other people don't see. No other soldier sees what the medic sees, because when they're called to the scene of an accident, we're the only ones there. And I cannot even describe and would not try to describe the carnage that can happen to a human being's body in a war situation. So I've had those things to deal with as I came back into a civilian world. And again, I loved what I did. And of course, psychology and sociology are people type subjects, and fit right in.
We're talking to Jim McLuhan. In 2002, he was inducted into the Michigan High School Coaches Hall of Fame. And in 2019, he was inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. Tall cotton. Jim, you came back from Vietnam in 1970. And up until June of 17, how many friends, neighbors, and or students did you share those 48 hours with?
Nobody. As a matter of fact, the only thing about that 48 hours that I shared was that 4 months after the battle, my platoon medic came to me and said, "Doc, I put you in for the Distinguished Service Cross for your actions in Tam Kỳ, New Yon Hill. And my superiors told me that you're nothing but a PFC and they don't get that. Put him in for the Bronze Star." Well, he did, and of course it went through, and I did receive another Bronze Star for other actions. But the only two people, and the only thing I talked about was that I had been discriminated against, and I told my father and I told my uncle. I had talked to no one about that battle for two reasons. Number one, I didn't want to go there. I had fought the battle, it was behind me, and I didn't want to fight the ghost of that battle for days to come. The other reason, you wouldn't believe me if I told you what happened anyway. If you read that citation, I think you realize that I'm a real lucky man to be alive.
Okay, on June 13th, 2017, at 11 a.m., something happened. What happened?
Oh, on June 13th, that was 2 weeks after the president had called me and told us that we had to be quiet because they hadn't picked a date. He told me that he would be presenting me and I would be his first Medal of Honor recipient, but they didn't know when, so we had to be quiet. We could tell two people. Told my two sons that we would be receiving it. But on June 13th, 2 weeks later, I got a call from a Colonel Walters out of the Pentagon, and she told me, it was 5 minutes to 11, and she said, "Jim, in 5 minutes, the United States of America and the world will know that James McLuhan will receive the Medal of Honor on July the 31st. I thanked her. And I hung up and I called my wife and I said, "Watch the news. I'm about to tee off." I was going to play golf that day, and I had practiced putted. And I had two of my buddies, matter of fact, the two that I golfed with today, were going to come and golf with me. And they didn't believe me when I told them I was going to get the Medal of Honor, because I'd never they thought I was joking around. I'm quite a jokester. And they thought I was joking around. And as a matter of flat fact, click ahead to the day that I received the medal, my son, who's a lieutenant detective with the state police, got a call from his sergeant detective, and he said, "Jamie, I saw your father get the Medal of Honor from President Trump on TV today. When did you first hear this story?" And my son said, "Today, the same time you did." It's very difficult. Anybody that's been in my boots will tell you that when you get together with your buddies, you don't even talk about it, but you feel that brotherhood, that you know what each other has gone through. You know what I mean? So it's very comforting to be around those that you have been in battle with, because even if certain things come up about Vietnam or when you were in the service, you can either laugh or cry about it together and know what each other is thinking and what each other has gone through.
We're talking to Jim McLuhan, and on July 31st, 2017, President Donald J. Trump presented him our country's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. And we're all proud of Jim McLuhan. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to a Medal of Honor recipient, one of 67 living such heroes. Jim, July 31st, 2017, you're in the East Room with your family, with 10 of your team from that company. You're with eight, I believe, other Medal of Honor winners. What was that day like?
Well, that was pretty surreal. And to get to that day, nine of my men had written eyewitness letters. And it wasn't until the case came across the desk of Ashton Carter that the lieutenant was going back after his original Distinguished Service Cross. And Ashton Carter read the eyewitness letters and the many, many, many things that the lieutenant had put together and sent him to the Pentagon. And he said that the Distinguished Service Cross was not high enough. So he raised it to the Medal of Honor. Now, that Medal of Honor, I don't know if you know this or not, has to be given within the first 5 years after the battle. And it had been 48 years at that particular time that the battle had taken place. So Debbie Stabenow literally had to write up a bill to waive the five-year stipulation. And it was passed in the Congress in 2016, December of 2016. So, yeah, only 32 of us walked out of the battle, as I mentioned a little earlier. And 9 of those wrote an eyewitness letter. And I don't know who, I think I know who the superior was that said he's nothing but a PFC, and they don't get that. But actually, God has a plan. And since 9 guys that were there got to write it, and the guy that said that I shouldn't get the Distinguished Service Cross wasn't even in the battle. I know that for a fact. And so the guys that got to see what we went through got to write up about the battle. And that medal belongs to them as well as myself. It belongs to 89 men that went into the battle, whether they made it or they didn't. And as I said earlier, nobody does anything alone. It took 89 men. And when we were down to just 32 fighting men, it took 32 men to just fight like cats in a corner to get each other out of there alive. It was a surreal thing, though, but what a wonderful feeling to be in the room with those individuals that you love so much, your family and your friends, the buddies that you were there, and 5 of those 10 that were in that room I actually had saved on that in that battle. And one of the men in that room was a young man, and his father was one of my best friends. We went through basic training together, and then we ended up in the same company together in Vietnam. It's so unusual. And his father was killed when he was robbed in 1975. And so that young man was there to take his father's place with my men. And what a great opportunity for him to hear from those men about his father. And he was 3 years old when his father was killed here in the United States. And his name is Wade Kairos, and his dad's name was Mike Kairos, one of my best friends and one of my brothers in arms. So to put all that in perspective and to be in a room with them and a lot of very, very important people, of course, from the United States Army and the Congress were in the room, and lots of reporters in the room. But what a day it was to share that moment with people that are so important to you.
You were the first Medal of Honor winner that President Trump put that medal around your neck.
Right.
Okay.
I'm not a Medal of Honor winner. I'm a Medal of Honor recipient.
I apologize.
Yeah, there was no contest. Yeah.
All right. I quote you now. This medal is all about love. It's a love story so deep in my soul that it's truly immeasurable. Jim, please.
It's about 89 men that were sent into a slaughter, and actually together, each person doing their part on the team and getting help from other parts of the big team, like the Air Force and the Marines and the Navy. That's what that medal's all about. And it's about, I worked on anywhere from 40 to 50 men. I went into the kill zone to save 10 Americans and 1 Vietnamese interpreter who would have either been killed or captured. That's what makes it very dangerous to go into the kill zone, knowing that you could be one of those victims yourself. But the fact is that my wife points out to me that I saved 10 American families, and I saved, generations, 1 Vietnamese interpreter's family too. So I saved some family trees in those 2 days. That's very rewarding to know that not only did I, but everybody else that was in the battle helped to save those particular family trees.
In doing research, one of the write-ups I start to read, as the ceremony came to close, he and Trump embraced. Amid the applause, McLuhan pointed to several family members and friends in attendance. The president beamed. A blessing was offered by the attending chaplain, and the 2 men hugged once more. McLuhan pulled the president close and spoke into his ear. It's unclear what was said, but in response, Trump looked at him and appeared to nod in affirmation. If you would, what did you say to President Trump?
Well, I thanked him for his leadership as a president and for being the president. He didn't have to step out of his private life. And I know I would want to be the president of the United States. And I always have been taught to respect people in those kinds of positions. And so I thanked him for being our president, for giving up his private life that could have kept him away from having to make the kind of decisions that he has to make. But I was very proud to be his first Medal of Honor recipient. It was kind of a special night.
The process was actually started under President Obama and Ashton Carter.
I have a very unusual medal there because there are two Secretary of Defenses, Ashton Carter and James Mattis. There are two presidents, Obama and Trump, and two secretaries of the Army. The Secretary of the Army has to sign off on that also. So, yeah, it's a special medal. I knew that Obama, he signed the bill that was passed in Congress to waive the 5-year stipulation in December. And I knew when he came home, he signed it on the 23rd, and he would be home after the holidays, and then he would only have 20 days left. So I knew there wasn't enough time for him to give it. But we heard nothing, actually, for 5 months then after Obama signed the bill. And that's because you had to change of commands, you know, and the 100 days that President Trump had to deal with. And so, we heard nothing until May 25th of 2017 after Obama had signed it on the 23rd of December 2016.
We're talking to Jim McLuhan. He's one of 67 living Medal of Honor recipients. Jim, you said you thanked President Trump. Well, we all thank you and those 89 young men of that company against 2,700 Vietnamese. Thank you for all you did there. Thank you for the 38 years of teaching, all the decades of coaching, and today, all the rounds of golf. Please keep it up.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.
Believe in yourself.